Now, I am delighted, and I mean this sincerely, to welcome a regular contributor, Michelle Murphy from Social Justice Ireland, to the programme. Now, I am well aware that my colleague Michael Sullivan conducted an interview with her colleague, Eamon Murphy, last Friday in relation to budget, the upcoming budget. But I will be talking to Michelle in relation to the budget, but I will be taking the little chat in a different direction. First of all, good morning, Michelle, and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Donny. Thank you very much.
You are more than welcome, dear. Michelle, I would be looking at this budget with fear and trepidation because I think that no matter how big the pie is, and I don't think it is really that big, with COVID-19, I think the slices are going to be tiny.
You're right, Donny. I actually would be quite concerned. I mean, what I suppose we would be hearing is that the pie, for want of a better word, is about 900 million, you know, which is not huge, you know, on any given year. But when you look at the current situation that we're in, it's very challenging, very, very challenging.
Now, Michelle, maybe we could just put a bit of a structure on this by outlining briefly, because I don't really want to go back over the ground that Michael and Eamon ploughed last Friday, but what submissions did Social Justice Ireland make to the Department of Finance in relation to the upcoming budget?
The strategic structure around it was essentially that you need to invest. The government needs to go to the markets, borrow the money. They can borrow at record levels of interest rates and invest that strategically in our infrastructure, in our services, and that will pay dividends in the longer term. And if you invest that money properly, you can manage that debt sustainably over a considerable period of time. The second thing is that we need to get away from this absolute fixation with prudent finances and our debt ratio, and we need to look at an employment target to guard us for the next 3 years, because we need to look at all those people who have lost their jobs, who are on a wage subsidy scheme, young people now coming out of college to a very challenging labour market, those who are already unemployed prior to COVID, you know, will find it very challenging to get a job at the moment. So we need an employment target. Forget about your deficit target. Forget about your prudent finances, which over the weekend we've been hearing again. We need to get away from that fixation. Invest in services and infrastructure. Borrow the money you need to do that. And look at how we can make our country better placed to meet any future challenges. You know, we certainly weren't well placed to meet this one, and you could argue that a lot of countries weren't. But, you know, we've spoken many times, Tony, over the challenges we face in terms of housing, healthcare, or poverty, for example. I mean, there's been a decade at least to get to grips with these. We failed to do it. We can't keep going along the same path.
Yeah, I mean, we have. I just, before I go on, Michelle, it's just something that struck me while you were talking there about, you know, prudence and changing tack and coming at this from a different angle. Does any little part of you feel sorry for Pascal Donoghue? Because I, and Michael McGrath, I suppose, too, as well, that they're being hit at this stage from so many angles, financially, with COVID, with the HSE, with everything that's gone on, that they don't know which way is up, I would imagine, at this stage.
You know, of course, it's incredibly challenging for them. I mean, we have to acknowledge that. But I suppose there's two things you can do here. The first thing is look at the COVID, the direct COVID costs. So the European Commission has invoked the clause in the Stability and Growth Pact so that it's called an escape clause, so that the COVID, direct COVID-related costs are not going to be considered in terms of, you know, the European Commission's annual review of whether we meet the debt-to-GDP ratios and other things in terms of our Stability and Growth Pact. And, you know, what we signed up to in the fiscal treaty. So those costs are not going to be considered. So the first thing you do is you separate out your COVID costs, and they are significant. No one is denying that, but you separate them out. You look at European funding to address them. You also look at warehousing them at a European level. So look for the support of other EU member states, and that's a separate issue. The European Commission have already acknowledged this, and they've put the money in place to deal with it. Then you need to look at those challenges that were there prior to the election in February that are still there now. How do we address those? What sort of borrowing and investment do we need to do? How do we make sure, you know, that investment is done over a longer term? We manage that debt over a longer term. And how do we put our public finances, our economic policy in such a place that when a recovery eventually comes, we can take advantage of it at this time, that we don't leave people behind?
And can I put a little sentence on the end of that, Michelle, that if we succeed in creating a budget which doesn't leave people behind, it will be the first time in the history of the state, I think, that it has happened, because I see it, and I see it in a microcosm here because of the work I do and people I talk to and things I see within the communities that we deal with. You must see it really under the microscope, and it's something that we have spoken about, Michelle, more times than I care to remember, is that from what I can see, and I see the same thing happening with this, that the gap between richer and poorer is expanding instead of contracting.
Yes, it's growing, and in fact it has grown as a result of the pandemic, because you've seen the upward redistribution of resources and the sort of capital flight, for want of a better term. And obviously those people who are shareholders or owners of MNCs that have taken advantage of the crisis, you know, they have seen a considerable increase in their incomes, whereas other people have seen huge drops in their income. And we spoke recently about the deprivation data, which was very concerning, and that's in relation to 2019 figures. So one would be considerably more worried about what's going to happen in 2020 in terms of the impact on poverty and deprivation. And unless we do something about this gap, we're going to find ourselves in a very difficult situation. And I would be very concerned about remarks made by the Minister for Social Protection over the weekend when asked about social welfare rates, and her opinion that huge increases shouldn't, or increases of any kind shouldn't really be considered, because she's looking at, a very small pocket of money. And, she's kind of looking at the people on the pandemic unemployment payment, but then look at all those people who are surviving on €203 a week, which is, you know, it's below the poverty line. And the fact that the pandemic unemployment rate is set at, even though it's been reduced at a much higher rate than that, was an acknowledgement by government that people couldn't survive on €203 a week. And I would be very concerned that yet again, people on social welfare will be left behind. They were ignored in the last budget. They didn't get an increase. And you've seen the result of that now. Because in real terms, their income fell. Because they had no increase, yet prices increased. You had electricity prices increasing actually earlier this year, and they're about to increase again. There's no way to avoid that. Housing costs increase, the cost of food increase, and it will increase again depending on what sort of outcome there are in terms of the Brexit negotiations, but chances are it won't be very favourable, and we're so connected to the UK in terms of our supermarket distribution system, you're going to see an increase in the price of food. And if you don't address social welfare and increase the core social welfare rate, so the 203 rate in this budget, those people are going to be left in a very, very challenging position.
Well, we heard during the week, Michelle, and I'm sure you heard it as well, during last week, from the Road Haulage Association, who said that there is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that the price of goods on the shelves is going to go up as a result of Brexit. And they are basing that on the extra costs that they are going to have to incur in relation to, as you say, using the land bridge of Britain?
Yes, and I mean, you're looking at an increase in costs, potentially between about 900 to 1300 euros in a year for a household's grocery shop. And those are things like cereal, bread, milk, eggs. It's, you know, they're not luxury items. They're the things we all buy every week when we go to the supermarket or the shop, and they're essential staples in any household and when you're providing food for your family. So we would really be urging the Minister for Social Protection in this budget not to repeat the mistake of Budget 2020 by ignoring those people who are most vulnerable in society, and increase the social welfare rates. Now, she has two options here, because we need to get to a benchmark of 27.5% of average weekly earnings. So that's a gap of about 21 euros. So she can make a choice. She can do it either over a 2 or 3 year period. So if you want to do it over a 3 year period, you're looking at an increase of 7 euros this year in this budget, Budget 2022 and Budget 2023. If you want to do it in a shorter period of time, you'd be looking at 10 euros in Budget 2021 and 10 euros in Budget 2022. I imagine, given her remarks regarding the challenges she faces and obviously other things that we've heard, and if the, you know, that there is just 900 million euros available, then we would be saying to look at this over a 3 year period, but you have to increase the core social welfare rates in Budget 2021, because if you don't, those people will be left behind again. They were left behind in 2008. We're going to repeat the same mistakes again, and those people are going to be left in persistent poverty, and there's a long term social and economic cost to that.
Michelle, we have seen the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain, Rishi Sunak, saying that he is in such financial uncertainty that he is not introducing a budget in Britain this year. Was there anything to be said for us following suit? Because I know historically, and I am a good deal older than you, Michelle, so we tend to mimic Britain in what we do. But was there anything to be said for Pascal Dunhu saying, lads, everything is so up in the air, there's absolutely no point in me introducing a budget this year, because we really don't know where we are?
Well, I don't think they would have been able to, because we have to submit our budget to the European Commission as part of the European semester process. So we have to submit a national budget by, I think it has to be submitted by the 14th of October this year. However, I think there is a very strong possibility that there will be a supplementary budget if there is a very difficult Brexit, and if we continue to face the COVID challenges over the winter. I mean, Dublin is obviously on, I think we're on week two now, aren't we, of level three. Donegal has moved to level three. You're looking at other counties. You know, businesses that were about to reopen or had reopened, all of a sudden closed again, changes to the wage subsidy scheme, changes to the pandemic unemployment payment. I mean, it's been so incredibly difficult for businesses, small businesses, and for people in general. And if we're going to continue to see these rolling restrictions, which obviously on public health terms we need to see, because our public hospital system is in a very challenging place at the moment, then I would say you have a very, very strong possibility of a supplementary budget in the new year to deal with both the COVID-19 issues and also the, you know, Brexit itself. Because if we keep, you know, opening and closing and opening and closing and changing the sort of the rules for businesses and for people, it's going to be very challenging for them. And also people are confused as to what they can or cannot do at the moment. And you also have a hospital system which now was not almost, you know, in April we shut it down more or less and we dealt primarily with COVID, and so many other treatments were postponed and delayed. Now those treatments are starting again. So you're running a system where you have cancer treatments and various other treatments working along side by side with also dealing with people who contract coronavirus. That's very difficult for hospitals, you know, in terms of even the distancing element and, you know, how you make sure that issues don't transfer in terms of wards and in terms of staffing. So we're facing into a very difficult winter. I think there's a very high possibility we'll have a supplementary budget. And I would hope that this government do not become fixated on the level of national debt. What we need to become fixated on is investing in infrastructure, in social infrastructure, in services, and making sure that we have a society and an economy that is well placed to take advantage of any recovery when it does come.
Yeah, and just on an aside to that, and just to, I suppose, to add maybe to your point a little bit, and it's not something really that you and I should be discussing on air because neither of us are experts in it, but anecdotally, I have to say that I am worried, is the phrase I would use, at how fast our hospital service seemed to come under pressure again once the numbers started to rise. And that is a worrying thing because it was always my fear, Michelle, right from the very start of this, that we would have a situation where COVID-19 and the flu season would collide in or around this time of the year. And it looks like that my worst fears may have come to pass.
Yes, I mean, we're all well aware of the challenges. We talk about them every year, the number of people on trolleys, the lack of step-down care, the lack of investment in community care. And I suppose COVID just has really shone a light on this because for, years we've been told, international agencies have looked at our health system and look at how reliant we are on what they call the acute health service. So we're so reliant on the hospitals. We don't treat people in the communities. We treat people in hospitals primarily because we don't have, a proper primary care network and a proper primary care system because we haven't invested in it. So now you get to a situation where, there is the potential for our hospital system to become overwhelmed. And in terms of the amount of ICU beds we have per head of the population and the occupancy rate for those beds, we're very high when you compare us to the rest of the OECD. And that is one of the huge, huge challenges we face. And, we see the winter plan, the huge amount of money that has been made available to the health system, but we need to look beyond that because you still need to build the social care network, the community care network and the primary care network to take the pressure off the hospital. So in the long run, we'll be able to deal with a lot of this in the communities. And then you also have to look at all those people who have lost their, people with a disability, for example, who've lost their facilities, their day activities that were taken from them in April and have yet to be reinstated, and the huge long-term damage that is being done to those people, as a result of COVID and because of the persistent lack of investment and also the pressure that is being put on carers, the huge amount of work that the carers that they contribute to society because they do this work unpaid and the hours they do every week, the huge amount of pressure that is being put on them as well. So, I suppose it's shone a light on the decades of neglect of the healthcare system in terms of investing outside of the acute system. We need to address that. I'd hope to be seeing some of that in the budget. And I think until such time as we do begin to invest outside of the acute system, we will consistently face challenges. Even as we do get over this crisis, as you say, every year when it comes to flu season, we seem to become overwhelmed. So we have to look at investments in launch care, primary care, community care and social care, outside of the acute system in this budget, as well as the money the acute system needs to deal with COVID.
Michelle, listening to you there, something came into my mind. Now, this is going to sound completely off the wall, but I'll have a go anyway. Is it time that we, as a country, stopped mimicking other places and reassessed how we do things in Ireland? Because no matter what happens, we always seem to be chasing the issue. We're never in front of it, ever. We're never, you know, okay, COVID-19 or coronavirus or whatever you want to call it, that's different because that came out of the blue, even though experts worldwide were warning us for the last 10 years that a pandemic would come and would ravage the world. But in other issues, we always seem to be chasing the problem. We never seem to be in front of it with the resources in place to deal with it or eradicate it. I mean, as long as I know you, we have been talking about issues like this. As long as I know Anthony Flynn, and I think that's coming up probably on 10 years, we have been discussing the issue of housing and social inequality and what people's needs are. We're still talking about it. In 10 years' time, is there going to be somebody else here talking to you about the exact same issues again? Because we still haven't solved them.
I think you certainly have a point, Tony, that we do need to... We know the problems that we have in this country. The data is there. We know what we need in terms of what's required to address them. Obviously, you can look at international best practice, but you have to apply it in Ireland and in the Irish context. But you know, there's a lot of things that we do well in this country too. You know, we focus a lot on what we don't do well, but maybe we should look at what we do actually do well. Why is it that we do that well? You know, what are the policies that are implemented? You know, how is it done? Is it done on a local level, a regional level, a national level? And can you replicate that across the system? You know, it's not incredibly difficult. I suppose one of the challenges we do have is our electoral cycle and our sort of fixation on short-term successes, whereas, you know, a lot of these challenges, you know, they take time to address, and perhaps the minister who might implement a policy won't be the minister there to take the credit for it in 5, 6, 7 years' time. But, I mean, Irish people certainly, I don't think, have that same sort of short-termism that's sort of built into our electoral system. They just want to see solutions to the problems that they see on a daily basis. And they can understand that, you know, things take time. Certain things take time. You can't build houses overnight, for example, but you can't build a certain amount of houses every year and begin to deal with your housing crisis. For example, rather than consistently publishing new strategies, housing strategies I'm talking about here, you simply go and build the social housing that people require. We know how many people need it. We know how many houses are needed. So perhaps we should just start building those houses, for example. So I certainly would agree with you in that respect that we need to just tackle some challenges head on. I'll give another example here, actually, which is disability. So last year's budget, Minister Donoghue announced that there was going to be a consultation undertaken and I suppose an exploration by Indicon into the cost of disability. This was done 10 years ago. More than 10 years ago, actually, by the National Disability Authority, and the results haven't changed because we didn't actually do anything with that information at the time about how to address the cost of disability, and we didn't introduce the cost of disability payment. So what we're doing is the problem has remained. We're examining it again. We're not going to get any different answers. We'll get the same answers with some updated figures. I think about 15 years have elapsed. But is government then going to actually implement any of the recommendations of the report, because they didn't implement the recommendations of the last report? And I think that's why people get, cynical and worn out and tired by the system. You know, we know what's needed to address the cost of disability. It just requires a government and a minister willing to do something about it. And for the past 15 years, we haven't done that. Maybe we'll have someone who will do something about it now, but...
I don't get the impression that you're holding your breath there, Michelle. I have to be honest with you. I definitely do not get that impression. Two things spring to mind from what you have said, my dear. Number one, I remember speaking to a politician one night in a hostelry which shall remain nameless, and he was speaking off the record and honestly, and he said the first duty of any politician on becoming elected is to make sure that they get re-elected the next time round. And also following on from what you have said there on that anecdotal story, Michelle, it brings to mind the definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results. And I mean, we as a collective, we as a government, there has to be a massive, one of the biggest buildings in this country has to be dedicated somewhere that we don't know about to hold reports about reports about reports and surveys about reports. And yet, as you say, where's the brick on top of the brick? Where's the extra care for people with disabilities? And I mean, we all know anecdotal stories about people, God help us, that are in wheelchairs and the struggle they have to get the wheelchairs renewed, fixed, get a new one when it's required. I mean, it beggars belief.
It does, and I mean, I think that's what's sort of engendered. People just become worn out by the system, you say, by the sort of repetition of surveys and the lack of, I suppose, real tackling of, you know, the problems that we face, and you know, really looking at how you might do something about it and how you might make a difference. And, you know, I think now if we're facing into a budget with 900 million as being what's available, if you look at all the government departments, that's not a considerable amount of money when you look at the challenges that we face. So you would hope that the government would be strategic about how it invests it, and that it invests that money to get the greatest return, and that it invests that money to make sure that we don't leave people, that this time we don't leave people behind. And so social welfare rates have to be a part of that, as does investing in things like community care, primary care, stepping care, all of these things that we've discussed. I mean, we didn't really see it in the last budget. I would hope that perhaps the crisis, having shone a light on so many challenges, and we haven't even spoken about the high pupil teacher ratios and classroom sizes has led to the challenge that, you know, we've a 2 meter social distancing rule that doesn't apply to schools because we simply can't accommodate it, because for decades we've also ignored how high our class sizes are. That maybe we might look at perhaps addressing some of these challenges in the budget, and government seeing it as an opportunity to actually get some things right and do something to improve everybody's standards of living as a first step. You know, they make a lot of commitments in the programme for government. A lot of them are good commitments. Haven't really seen how they're going to deliver on it yet. This budget is probably going to be we'll get an idea then of how they plan on delivering that programme through the budget. So I would certainly expect to see a focus on living standards, well-being and investment in this budget, and not a fixation with the national debt.
And Michelle, before I let you go, because we're extremely tight on time, we have mentioned the budget, we have mentioned what we want in the budget, we have mentioned the word budget, I'd say 300 times in the last 30 minutes. What date is the budget this year?
The budget this year is on Tuesday, the 6th of October.
In all money, so, it's tomorrow week.
Yes. Exactly. So there is not a significant amount of time. It's Tuesday the 13th of October. I know that because I had to move a meeting.
That's Tuesday, 2 weeks.
It's 3 weeks. Yeah, Tuesday, 2 weeks. And I had to move a meeting, a group meeting that day. So Tuesday, 2 weeks. It feels like, I mean, at this stage, Tony, it could be next Tuesday because, you know, in terms of the discussions that we're having and the challenges that we face, but it's the 13th of October, and either the day after, 2 days after, they're publishing their national economic plan, which people should also keep an eye on, because that will give an idea of what direction this government is going in for the entire 5-year term, you know, and where it sees our economy and society going. So it's not just the budget, the national economic plan, I would certainly advise everybody to look at as well.
Michelle Murphy from Social Justice Ireland, as always, Michelle, so givish and so gracious with your time. I really appreciate it. I think you and I will have another chat maybe the week after the budget when we've had a chance to dissect it and digest it, and we'll see what we come up with and where we think people are going to benefit, and I hope that people are going to benefit. Michelle, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Tony. Good morning.
Bye-bye.